KPFA Berkeley, KPFB Berkeley, KFCF Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.
Good morning. It's a KPFA morning show on your Monday, November 30th, 2009. Hope everyone enjoyed the holiday. I'm Amy Allison. Philip Mulder will be back next week. We start out our program looking at the surge in Afghanistan. President Obama is set to announce tomorrow that he intends to commit tens of thousands of more troops to Afghanistan and extend the war. It'll become the longest war in American history. Norm Solomon will be in, director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, to have the conversation right after the news with Eileen Alfandering. Good morning.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, everyone. Honduras remains divided a day after disputed presidential elections. Hondurans who went to the polls elected conservative rancher Porfirio Lobo. Lobo said his main task is united the country. His remarks were translated by English Al Jazeera.
We want to establish a national dialogue and invite all sectors of the population without excluding anyone. I'm sure we will reach an understanding through dialogue. The country's interest must come before any particular interest.
But supporters of ousted President Manuel Zelaya boycotted the polls and no pro-Zelaya candidate ran for election. In San Francisco yesterday, about 100 pro-Zelaya protesters rallied outside the Honduran consulate.
Honduras no se vende. Honduras se defiende. These elections are illegitimate. Because they are done under the context of a non-democratically elected government and also in the context of repression. The coup d'etat government and the military in Honduras are repressing. They have captured, they have disappeared, they have killed a lot of the people who are against these elections.
The U.S. and Canada have said they will recognize the election. Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela have said they won't. The Organization of American States and the European Union refused to send election observers to Honduras. 10 years after the so-called battle in Seattle, the United States, China, and other top global economic powers are gathering in Geneva. The World Trade Organization has no specific global trade deal to discuss, but the wreckage caused by the global economic meltdown has spurred protests anyway. On Saturday, Swiss police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. They broke windows and set cars on fire. The trade summit in Switzerland takes place a week before global climate talks get underway in Copenhagen. Today marks a day of action for global climate justice. Rallies, marches, and civil disobedience are planned around the U.S. and the world. In San Francisco, there's an 11:30 a.m. rally at Justin Herman Plaza, followed by a march to Bank of America. Organizers say that as with protests against the World Trade Organization 10 years ago, the climate justice movement is focusing on unaccountable corporate power. Gopal Dianeni is with Movement Generation.
We're organizing today on November 30th, the 10th anniversary of the collapse of the WTO in Seattle, to demand real action on climate that serves the needs of communities all over the planet, including here at home, and against the false solutions of carbon trading and offsets.
What is your best hope for what could happen in Copenhagen?
Copenhagen is both the opportunity for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to move forward with strong action by countries in the global south demanding a rights-based approach to climate policy. We don't expect that that's going to happen. What we do expect is going to happen is popular movements will converge on Copenhagen and around the world to amplify the voices of people who are being impacted by climate disruption and the false solutions that are being proposed by the United States.
And very briefly, when you say rights-based decisions or rights-based solutions, what are those?
First, we need a funds-based mechanism for financing both mitigation for future carbon emissions and adaptation to the impacts of climate change that we know are already coming, as opposed to a market-based system in which corporations like Bank of America and others have the right to make money off of the buying and selling of the right to pollute our air. We need the transfer of technology, clean technologies from the global north to the global south. We need between 45 and 50% reductions relative to 1990 levels by 2020, not the 3% reduction being proposed by the United States. That's based almost entirely in offsets, which is the shell game of polluting here, being able to pollute in the United States without reducing our emissions here, but supposedly reducing emissions in other parts of the world, a system that we know doesn't work.
Gopal Dianeni, KPFA will preview today's actions on the morning show at 8:30. We'll have a full wrap-up of the day's events on the evening news tonight at 6. Iran's nuclear chief today blamed the UN nuclear watchdog, saying a critical report is pushing Iran to develop new nuclear facilities. The country's vice president said Iran's decision to build 10 new uranium enrichment facilities was necessary after the International Atomic Energy Agency's resolution Friday demanded that Iran halt all enrichment activities. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced the decision.
Our Atomic Energy Organization is obliged, as of now, to begin working on 5 sites. They must also suggest locations for 5 new sites. Altogether, there will be 10 new sites for nuclear fuel production at all required facilities.
Russia said it was seriously concerned by the proposal for a huge expansion of Iran's nuclear program. The Obama administration condemned the plans as a serious violation of UN Security Council resolutions demanding Iran suspend uranium enrichment. President Obama is preparing to give a defining speech of his presidency. Tomorrow at 5, he'll address the nation on the Afghan war. Obama is expected to announce he'll send 30 or 35,000 more U.S. troops. He may lay out a plan for winding down the conflict at the same time he escalates it. Polls show a U.S. public evenly divided on the war. Among the public, Republicans overwhelmingly favor sending more troops. A majority of Democrats are opposed. Carl Levin, the Democratic chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said yesterday he could support the dispatch of more troops under certain conditions.
I do not believe we should send more combat forces at this time. That's been my position. Combat forces are where we are the ones doing the fighting without an Afghan partner. If we have Afghan partners that are fully involved in the fight, partnering with us, which is on-the-job training for them, critically important, I can be more supportive.
Representative David Obey, who chairs the House Appropriations Committee that oversees a large chunk of government spending, said that instead of the war, the government should be funding education and rebuilding the U.S. economy. The Senate today begins debate on health care reform, but signs of fracture are clear in the crucial Democratic support needed to pass a measure. Some Democratic senators want tighter restrictions on abortion coverage, like those contained in the House bill. Others say they'll bolt if the government insurance public option is included. Liberal senators say they won't vote for a bill without the public option. And no Republicans are likely to cross party lines. In Uruguay, a former guerrilla fighter has become president. Jose Mujica won 53% of the vote in his runoff against a conservative rival. He is expected to follow in the footsteps of Uruguay's outgoing president with policies friendly to investors, but with a strong commitment to social policies. The previous government pushed a progressive income tax to fund social programs that have reduced poverty and unemployment in Uruguay to its lowest level in decades. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny with highs in the lower to mid 60s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy dense morning fog, high 61 to 66 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. I'll have more news at 7:30. You're listening to The Morning Show on KPFA.
Good morning. It's a KPFA morning show on your Monday, November 30th, 2009. I'm Amy Allison, and starting off our program, Norman Solomon, director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, will be in the studio to discuss the anticipated announcement by President Obama to expand and extend the war in Afghanistan. At 7:30, a ground view of life in another edition of Poor News Network. And then at 8 o'clock, think Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, Paul Wolfowitz, and all those folks keep popping up, the same names. Well, our guest at 8 o'clock says, you know, there's a shadow elite that is really representing a new type of corruption undermining our democracy, and she'll be in to talk about her new book, Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And then finally, as World Trade Organization protests heat up in Europe, Brian Edwards Seeker takes us back to Seattle and looks at what's happened in the struggle for world trade and self-determination across the globe, but Seattle 10 years later. All that coming up on The Morning Show, 11 minutes after the hour. All right, President Obama will address the United States Military Academy at West Point tomorrow, expected to announce his plan to send tens of thousands of more American troops into Afghanistan and to extend the Afghanistan war so it then becomes the longest war in American history. Norman Solomon, director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of War Made Easy, is in studio to tell us more. Thanks for coming back into the studio.
Pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. I saw that you wrote an article that was just published on commondreams.org, and you start by looking at the New York Times article this morning. An unnamed administration official says, quote, President Obama wants to give a clear sense of in the speech tomorrow both the time frame for action and how the war will eventually wind down. Sounds like they're really emphasizing the fact that the president is going to be saying, hey, we're going to escalate it, but we're also going to end it.
Yeah, this is very boilerplate overreach of hubris from Washington. We get to decide from the United States what the pivotal events will be, when they'll happen, what the timeline will be, when the war will eventually end. Of course, eventually it's a long time when people are being bombed and suffering so much in the process. You noted, Amy, a minute ago that the president's speech tomorrow night is scheduled for West Point, and I think that's quite significant because this is, after all, a profound historic political decision by an ostensibly civilian government president who was elected. And yet he chooses as a venue, President Obama chooses as a venue, not a joint session of Congress, but rather West Point, where predictably we'll have thousands of cheering people in uniform who are, after all, in the armed services. And I think that's unfortunately a bit of a metaphor for where we are now. The most loyal Democrat, so to speak, behind the Democrat in the Oval Office on the Afghanistan war issue are Republicans. That's true in the polls. It's true in the Congress.
I got to ask you, what President Obama, who came in on a wave of change, and progressives worked very hard in coalition to put him in office, what is he thinking now? Because I've heard, and last week you even mentioned this on the show, that he's putting his whole domestic agenda at risk.
Yeah, well, we still don't know, and we never will know what goes on in his head or anyone's head. But I think that the actions are speaking very loudly. I'm not aware of any progressive who would rather today have a President John McCain than a President Barack Obama. But that said, I believe that many progressives, and I was one of them, who worked to get Obama elected rather than John McCain, are in recent weeks and months, as policies become increasingly clear out of the White House, going through what you might call stages of grief, you know, denial, anger, bargaining. Oh, he's just doing this. He's just, he's throwing a progressive health care scenario overboard, but he has to do that. But surely he wouldn't be loony enough to escalate the war in Afghanistan. And so we're zipping through the stages of grief. I don't know if we've gotten through all half a dozen or more, but we have to come to terms with reality. This is an escalating war from a war president. And unless we can create enough grassroots pressure for Congress to refuse to appropriate more funds for this war, it will continue indefinitely.
Well, let's talk about that. Congresswoman Barbara Lee was in town talking about her legislation to do just that. Where does all that stand?
Well, it stands on some, I think, firm ethical and moral ground, but not on very solid horse trading ground on Capitol Hill. Barbara Lee's bill, H.R. 3699, would deny any funding for more deployment of U.S. troops to Afghanistan. The support does exist in the House, but it's underwhelming. It's not anywhere near majority, even among Democrats. You have another line coming out, for instance, from David Obey, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, very powerful, who's been saying in recent days that he doesn't think this war should be escalated, but he thinks if the war is going to go forward, then there needs to be a war surtax, so there's pay-as-you-go. Well, this is a rather curious and ultimately, I think, very hollow political position. This war is wrong and shouldn't be escalated, but if it's going to happen, we should be sure that the books are balanced, which is a total abdication of congressional responsibility.
I guess I don't follow that. That doesn't even seem logical to me.
What, you want logic out of these folks?
I want logic.
It's expediency. It's expediency of the type that we're hearing not only from Obey, but we're hearing from Anna Eshoo, a congresswoman from the Bay Area, South Bay, who has endorsed Obey's approach. We have Senator Jack Reed from the House Armed Services Committee just on CNN yesterday saying that, well, I'm not sure if this war is right, but if the Afghan army can be brought in more and more, then I think I would support the president's escalation. A supposed skeptic, Senator Carl Levin, said the same thing in the last day. This is, I think, fairly predictable, because when you have a president, the same party as those in Congress who might sometimes make anti-war noises, then there are many ways when push comes to shove for those members of Congress to be brought to heel. And I think that for progressives at the grassroots puts an enormous responsibility on us to do the grassroots organize to pressure every member of Congress and every senator. And after all, we vote for a member of Congress and both senators sooner or later. We should be raising hell and demanding not their misgivings and their hand-wringing, which really doesn't go very far, but it's the power of the purse. They vote for money for this war. They are part of the war machinery.
When's the vote going to come up?
Well, you know, supposedly supplementals are a thing of the past. But there is a lot of rumor mill around Capitol Hill that some appropriations bill will come forward tied to civilian aid in Pakistan and or Afghanistan, and perhaps, get this, tied in with a domestic jobs bill. So there's a lot of way to scatter this sort of a package to include, yes, escalating the war in Afghanistan, but also you want jobs at home, then vote for the bill. And it makes it easier for liberal to progressive members of Congress to vote for it.
So the issue, at least on Capitol Hill, is not whether the U.S. should extend their involvement in this war, but how it's going to be paid for, because there are some Democrats, like you were mentioning, a few that were saying, look, we shouldn't go further into debt to fight the war, but if we can figure out a way to pay for it, we should do that.
Well, I think that's where what passes for debate on this issue on Capitol Hill is devolving. And so you've had these, you know, somewhat by partisan Democrat terms, vocal critiques coming from, for instance, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, saying, I don't think an escalation is appropriate. But as President Obama has become more and more clearly dug in and identifying his presidency behind this escalation, you have these folks peeling away, Pelosi, Levin, Reid, Obey, others in the House and Senate, who it's sort of like, if you can't beat him, join him. It's our president, ahead of our party. And so then we're going to reshift the debate. Okay, let's finance it.
Take us back to when the president's decision, after really months of internal discussion, deliberation, it was leaked out to the public that he did intend to expand the war. Talk about the dynamic of that and what just that leak, how it played into public opinion.
Well, the dynamic is to put that scenario out in stages, trial balloons, and then the ceiling of new escalation becomes the floor months later. Let's remember that early this year, President Obama decided to send 21,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. Now that's a done deal. That's the floor upon which this other 30 to 35,000 deployment is taking place. And so we're ratcheted up the normal background radiation, so to speak, of militarism becomes increased and elevated. And then that's what things are measured by. The president is now moving ahead with a policy that next year will end up, we're told, putting 100,000 or having 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Afghanistan on top of at least 40,000 NATO forces, on top of at least the current amount of 70,000 private U.S. contractors in Afghanistan. You add all that up, we're in excess of 200,000 foreign forces, mostly Americans, in Afghanistan.
Take us back. Any lessons that we should be discussing from the buildup and escalation in the Vietnam conflict?
I think it's that we can't rely on members of Congress, after all is said and done and all their misgivings, to do what has to be done, which is to cut off the funding spigot for the war. That can only come from people who are based around the country, who are doing local and national work to persuade the population and activate people to actively oppose the war. You know, it's not enough to say, well, I don't support the war or I have misgivings. People in the White House don't much care if we don't support it. What they will be concerned about is if we actively organize against it. And, you know, people get discouraged because there aren't a lot of folks protesting in the streets. I think we do need to protest in the streeds, but we need to do a lot else to the do the education and agitation. And also a lesson, I think, is that unlike 40 years ago, we can now see the importance of including in our mix strong electoral work, because everybody in Congress is elected or reelected every 2 years, and we should be willing to mount primary challenges, I believe, against Democrats who may talk anti-war but vote for these wars. And that includes, of course, in the Bay Area.
I was going to ask you about that, because we have several in Northern and Central California who are supporting the war and the expansion of the war.
Oh, absolutely. You've got, as I mentioned, Anna Eshoo. You have Jerry McNerney. You have a number of them in the immediate Bay Area. Some are quite waffly, George Miller and so forth. I mean, obviously, these folks are generally entrenched. But if we simply are plaintive, or if we make a moral appeal without political muscle behind it, we're just going to get railroaded into this war train process for years to come. And it's about power. It's about leverage. And, you know, Frederick Douglass said it well. Power never concedes without struggle. It never did. It never will. And we will not be able to change this dynamic unless we buckle down more seriously in all realms, including the electoral one.
Norman Solomon's here on the KPFA Morning Show with the Institute for Public Accuracy. His new article, just published just about 2 hours ago on commondreams.org, responds directly to the fact that President Obama's intention for tomorrow night's speech is to expand the war in Afghanistan. I want to ask you about this, Norman, about the timetable. Go back to the New York Times article this morning. Administration officials, the article says, would not commit or disclose a particular time frame. They suggested that the president is going to discuss the time frame. In other words, Mr. Obama has committed to withdrawing most combat units by August and all forces by the end of 2011.
Yeah.
So, so it sounds like the intention is to tell the public that the president intends to expand the war and then end the war.
Yeah, we have to.
Again, we're searching for logic here.
Right. Yeah, it goes to the U.S. Army official who said in Vietnam we need to destroy the village in order to save it. We need to escalate the war in Afghanistan in order to end it. The notion that out of Washington these timelines can be dictated, when still in all we're told there's a commitment to do X, Y, and Z in Afghanistan, I think it is fanciful, and it fits a classic pattern during the Vietnam War as well. There were all kinds of notions floated that the U.S. will get out by X date. President George W. Bush's administration got its apparatchik columnist, now the late Robert Novak, to report before the 2004 election in his widely syndicated column that Rumsfeld and Bush were drawing up plans to withdraw from Iraq in 2005. I mean, these are floating horizons that are really part of the dynamic of escalation.
Well, tomorrow night, President Obama is expected to describe some of the commitments that they're going to expect from Afghanistan's president, Hamid Karzai, and specific benchmarks that the government in Afghanistan has to meet. Talk more about the dynamics there.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're maintaining and expanding a long-term occupation in a country, you need what is called the partner. That was true in Saigon for many years, sort of the rotating group, Diem, Key, Tu, these other names. Good help is hard to find when you're engaged in an imperial long-term adventure. But the reality is that the corruption is endemic. I saw that when I was in Afghanistan a few months ago. The poverty is horrific, not being addressed by any of these nostrums and the rhetorical flourishes coming out of Washington. And I think, I should say, as co-chair of the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign nationally from Progressive Democrats of America, with Donna Smith from California Nurses Association and Representative John Conyers, that notion, that commitment, really, to healthcare, not warfare, cuts across the globe. It's true in Afghanistan, where people are crying out for nutrition, for education, for healthcare, and it's true here at home. And, Amy, when you ask about lessons from the Vietnam War to the present time, I think one of them is we need to make more clear what the social and human costs are, not only in Afghanistan, but here at home. $30 billion, with a B, to pay for this expansion simply for the new 30,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
And on top of everything, all the other money that's already being spent.
Yeah, it's just an enormous outlay, which is going to be robbing us here at home. We have, in Sacramento, we're told, a new budget crisis coming up, $20 billion pretty soon in the hole. Again, you can imagine what that's going to do in our own communities, healthcare, education, housing, and all the rest of it. That deficit could be more than wiped out by the 1 year cost of sending those 30,000 troops.
Well, let me ask then, President Obama, a person that you worked by, we just said you worked really hard to get him into office and to get progressives to support him. And now that he's making the decision to expand the war in Afghanistan, do you think his domestic program is finished? I mean, I can't. I mean, how are you going to get the money to do both of those things?
Yeah, real candidly, there were a lot of reasons to be unhappy with the scope of the stimulus package, the bailout to Wall Street, the failure to create jobs. So even at its optimum, the scenarios for the domestic program signified no great shakes. But with this hemorrhaging of money for this very bloody and horrific war expansion and maintenance in Afghanistan, it's hard to imagine a domestic program that's worth a damn. That's a reality. This is theft from the children of this country.
I mean, people
and
need jobs. We talked about the health care hasn't even made it through the Senate yet.
So. Yeah, and that's where, and again, I think, as with everybody else, we need to ask for and demand of elected officials that they step up to the plate, because as they sort of waffle around and find rationales not to try to block funding for this expansion of the war and this war itself, they are engaged in a pilfering from the future of people in the United States. And sooner rather than later, they need to be called to account so this war can be stopped. I think sooner is better.
Yeah, you were discussing a kind of an electoral strategy aimed at the members of Congress who would be organized to, like, have challenges for them in their own districts if they support this additional money for war. That's a long-term strategy. So are you kind of saying, look, it looks like the war's expanded, it's going to happen, progressives on the ground need to organize longer term to deal with it?
Well, short to medium term, even, it's sort of a purloined letter. It's right hidden in plain sight in front of us. Congressional districts are dotting the map of everywhere we live in this country. If we are willing to take the time and put the energy into organizing to challenge and confront our members of Congress, it's not even necessarily that long-term a strategy. If we do it effectively, I would almost guarantee there are many members of the House from the Bay Area that if they see on the horizon a potentially significant primary challenge, Democratic primary challenge, coming down the pike at them next year, they will be finding their attention riveted pretty fast.
I want to be as optimistic as you in terms of that strategy, but we've seen the result of, let's say, Nancy Pelosi. Any kind of challenge in her district, she scoffed at.
Well, if we don't do it effectively, then they're going to scoff. If we don't do a project with methodical groundwork and really do it in a very, very serious way. If we do it badly, then it will come off badly. I believe that the math tells us the primary challenges in the Democratic Party are the most threatening to the reelection of pro-war Democrats.
And who's pulling that together nationally?
I think
maybe Norman Solomon.
Well, I think there are many groups and individuals and activists doing it. People want to go to the website of Progressive Democrats of America. It's pdamerica.org. There are primary challenges being mounted already across the country, including Jane Harman, the incumbent pro-war representative in Southern California in the L.A. area, already being challenged by Marcy Winograd, a very strong anti-war candidate in the primary coming up next June.
Interesting. Well, Norman Solomon, director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, author of an article just up on commondreams.org. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Amy.
All right. It is 7:31 here on the KPFA Morning Show. I'm Amy Allison, and stay tuned right after the news, a ground view of life with another edition of Poor News Network. Now it's time for the news.
Iran's nuclear chief today blamed the United Nations nuclear watchdog, saying a critical report is pushing Iran to develop new nuclear facilities. The country's vice president said Iran's decision to build 10 new uranium enrichment facilities was necessary after the International Atomic Energy Agency's resolution Friday demanded Iran halt all enrichment activities. The U.S. Supreme Court has overturned an appeals court ruling ordering the disclosure of photographs of detainees being abused by their U.S. captors. The High Court cited a recent change in federal law that allows the pictures to be withheld. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit to obtain the photos of detainee torture and abuse. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from California death row inmate Kevin Cooper. Cooper came within a few hours of execution in 2004 before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals stepped in to order genetic testing on a hair and a bloody shirt found at the murder scene that Cooper said would prove he was not the killer. Today marks a day of action for global climate justice. Rallies, marches, and civil disobedience are planned around the U.S. and the world. In San Francisco, there's an 11:30 a.m. rally at Justin Herman Plaza, followed by a march to Bank of America. Organizers say that as with protests against the World Trade Organization 10 years ago in Seattle, the climate justice movement is focusing on unaccountable corporate power. A White House official says some world leaders may change their schedules so they can attend an upcoming climate conference the same day as President Obama. Obama will attend the Copenhagen summit on December 9th before heading to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. More than 75 other world leaders will also attend the conference, though most were expected to arrive the following week. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny today with highs in the lower to mid 60s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy dense morning fog, then highs 61 to 66 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. I'll have more news at 8 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Show on KPFA.
It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication leads to...
Hola, este es Prensa Pobre Radio. Soy Tiny. Hija de Di, sabe usted indígena y pobreza y la reina del welfare. Welcome to Poor News Network. I'm your co-host, Tiny, poverty, indigenous scholar, daughter of Di, and welfare queen. In studio today is Poor News Network staff writer, co-maestro de Poetas Pobres and Poets Project, indígena and poverty scholar, Mutiado Silencio, and poverty and race scholar, poet and super baby daddy, Riate Akil McLaughlin, a.k.a. Ram.
The R is for revolutionary. The A is for action. And the S is for the struggle. Because all revolutionary action requires struggle.
This month's Poor News Network show is in honor of Native American Heritage Month. It's dedicated to mother and artist Cassandra Yazzie, as well as revolutionary journalist and friend of PNN, Andrea Lewis. In their honor, we will air the poetry from the indigenous youth scholars at the Boys and Girls Club at Southern Ute Indian Reservation.
We will feature a story on Diné people's struggle for ancestral lands, poetry and music from Native group, hip-hop group One Struggle, and more. Finally, we will present a statement in honor of our brothers and sisters in struggle against the rising tuitions on former institutions of learning on campuses across Califastlán.
Many nights, many obstacles. It's logical, the knowledge that you thought you knew. We got the fire in the circle of life. The dreamscape got you captive in the rapture inside that God creates. Manipulate.
As an organization that was launched by an indigena Taina, an Irish mother and daughter team, myself and Mama D, without whom there would be no me, who barely survived houselessness, landlessness, extreme poverty, disability, criminalization, racism, and survived on underground economic strategies. We at Poor Magazine identify as an indigenous people-led, poor people-led organization, which practices eldership, ancestor worship, and interdependence as a resistance to the destruction of capitalism, imperialism, colonization, and white supremacy. Poor Magazine defines indigenismo within an urban indigenous context of shared identities and shared struggles. We are African, Taino, Boricua, Mexicano, Mexica, Rasa, Iroquois, Pomo, Cherokee, Choctaw, Filipino, Chinese, Japanese, Celtic, Hawaiian, Samoan, Jewish, Arabic, South Asian, Oaxacan, Guatemalan, Salvadoran, and many more. Including our elders, our youth, our children, our mamas, our daddies, our grandmothers, grandfathers, abuelitos, abuelitas, families and individuals brought together through the shared struggle of poverty, survival, and thrival.
To this end, Poor Magazine has implemented the UN Declaration of Indigenous Peoples as a revolutionary resistance document, as well as multiple projects focused on hearing the silenced voices of poor, indigenous, migrant, disabled, incarcerated, occupied youth, and elders' scholars. One of these projects is Poor's Indigenous Peoples Media Project.
Poor Magazine was blessed to be invited by Poor's Indigenous Peoples Media Project coordinator and sister, Mari Villaluna, to the Southern Ute Indian Reservation Boys and Girls Club, together with Ross K.D. from Snag Magazine and Cassandra Yazzi from the Four Rivers Institute. We co-taught and co-led a workshop that taught beats, poetry, spoken word, and consciousness on occupation, land, survival, thrival, poverty, and resistance to over 35 youth from 8 to 18. I had the honor of meeting the amazing Cassandra Yazzi, a mother of four and a teacher, and an indigenous scholar herself of that tribe. And last week, in an accident, she was killed instantly on the road. And so it is with great sadness and also great honor that we dedicate today's show to her. As well, a friend, longtime friend of Poor News Network, probably one of the people who gave us respect at this station, KPFA, more than anyone else and for the longest, was the amazing Andrea Lewis. And so our tears and our love goes out to both of these powerful women. With an open heart, we say rest in peace and may your spirit journey be healthy and peaceful.
You are listening to a monthly broadcast of Poor News Network in honor of Native American Heritage Month on KPFA's morning show at 94.1 FM. The following slam bio poems were written by indigenous youth scholars at the Native Hip Hop Workshop at the Boys and Girls Club at Southern Ute Indian Reservations. And the workshop goes from ages 8 to 18. The exercise is a process we include in our youth and adult poetry workshops called the Slam Bios, using your biographies as poetry.
I'm Jacob Frost, and like a newly grown crabapple, sour like a lemon's kiss, the smell of rain-kissed leaves after a night's rain, the touch of soft silk, unique like a red panda. Not many of my Ute people culturally centered. My home is beautiful. I live in my world. My family fights to keep our culture alive. My sister's death was a difficult time to deal with. I was forced to grow up at age 11. The streaming green light reminds me to live in reality, but dream like I'm asleep.
Green colors and a color blue. my family.
I'm Alana Watts. I'm 12 years old. Blue, sweet, apples, smooth. Army Bear, strong. Southern Ute, strong. Ignacio. I live in a big house. I struggle with loving my mom and dad. I live with my mom. She's a single mom raising two kids. It's just so hard. Love is pink. Fighting is hard.
My name's Andrea, and I'm 8 years old. Yellow, juicy, sweet, wooden, panda bear, Mexican, downtown, mom, dad, Carlos, Nubia, sister.
My name is Malin. I'm 14. My color is green. My taste is spicy. My touch is soft. My smell is lavender. I am a tiger that roams the quiet lands. I belong to the Southern Ute tribe. They are as gentle as a cat's fur. I live with my dad. He is the cat's meow. My struggle is my life. I just moved from Oklahoma and my pride and joy. It was like I was running in the waters of my own sorrow.
I'm Kayla. I'm 10 years old and I'm Mexican. Blue, sour, sweet, soft. A bird that can fly over my mistakes. Ignacio. Downtown neighborhood, my baby sis, my bro, and my mama. My mind is making everything a struggle.
I'm Santana, and I'm 15. My slam bio is purple, brown, spicy, bittersweet, sour, soft, hard, scaly, pink panther. My culture is Mexican, and they are the shits. I live with my mom, my grandma, and my sister. My struggle is becoming the person everyone is becoming. Sometimes I wish I could give my life like I'm a donor. I rub the struggle in like a toner.
One youth scholar who didn't say her name in the last series was 8 years old, and her name is Odyssey. The next series of poems were from an exercise I created called Poema para Pachamama, a poem for Mother Earth, which is actually the beginning of a project that Poor Magazine will be doing over the next year and performing at a reclaiming, taking back Earth Day from corporate environmentalists at a celebration at Galería de la Raza in April of 2010. Here are the beautiful pieces created by the youth scholars. And again, the one young scholar who doesn't say her name is Odyssey.
I'm Alana. I'm 12 years old. The sky was so baby blue. I just couldn't stand it until I touched the ground. It was so calm. I felt like I was in heaven.
I'm Talia and I'm 13. And my poem's called My Mother Earth. It's my earth and it's my whole Southern Ute land. The cars, machines, and chainsaws are what is making her work hard. Even though it's the fall and we fall back in time, don't mean we have to fall back on the population of our wilderness. The gray, blue, and sunset orange skies get polluted and destroyed. It's my earth, your earth, you, and even you. Don't hurt her, don't make her cry.
My name is Kayla and I am 10 years old. The sky is gray, orange, and blue. While on the ground it is smooth, soft. And cold. Cars are coming and going. Trees have lost their leaves, but they're still sweet to us, telling us to smell, touch, and take care of them.
My name is Malin. I'm 14. The sky was orange, like a bright orange shawl. And the grass, it felt so calm, I could go to sleep. In my mind, it felt like the ants were building their home.
My name is Destiny. I'm 14. I walked out the doors. Instantly, the green on the ground, the blue in the sky caught my eye. The rocks that were caked by man were jumping for joy. The grass crunching as I ran my fingers through it. The lonely star in the sky was surrounded by many clouds.
My name is Valerie, and I'm 15. As I walked outside to the colors of red, blue, and orange, hearing the sounds of cars, voices, and machines as if men were working from a far distance. As I felt the grass, it seemed as everyone forgot what Mother Earth was creating for me and you.
Jacob, 17. I was outside and seeing the many color hues, the sound of Mother Earth blocked out by man-made things. It's noisy, but the tree is sleeping and standing silent. The grass dances around the tree peacefully. Last I see the silent spider scurrying across the cement. But all in all, I feel Mother Earth crying for help, and I am here to comfort her.
Santana in 12. The sea colored blue with the pink colored light soothed my mind as I laid in the comforting green grass, the sunset with the silver sparkling stars shining at me.
My name's Andrea, and I'm 8.
Okay. Do you want help reading it? Okay.
The sky in rotation, revolving around
the town, one star shining down at me as the sunset with the blue and pink shuffles in the sky, hearing the words of thank you.
I just interrupted herself. Everybody give me your attention.
This is my poem from Mother Earth. I like the earth and the places and the things and the world and the people. I take care of this place.
My name is Madi, short for Madi Posa. I am 29. I lay on the ground like as the way I do after the hottest sweat, laying my body on the cool, peaceful, healing ground. My head touches the green grass as the tip of my toes balance on the ground. My eyes see the father sky that has always watched over me, even when I forget that my father was always there. I see speckles in the sky that look like the shiny jingles on a jingle dress, the same dance that has healed the earth and many human beings. How their feet touch the ground up and down, but ever so lightly, touching lightly, but on a strong path on that red road.
Run it back, Selecta.
Rock the D. It's time to set these people free.
These are just an excerpt of the many beautiful pieces by Indigenous youth scholars on Poor Magazine. To read the whole series, go online to www.poormagazine.org and click on Indigenous Peoples Media Project. As well, for more youth work from a workshop that Poor Magazine Poetas Pobres Po Poets Project did at the San Leandro High School, click on Youth at Poor. And as well, look for the upcoming issue of Snag Magazine for a print copy of many of these young folks' beautiful work.
You are listening to the monthly edition of Poor News Network on KPFA's morning show at 94.1 FM. Next up, another story from Indigenous Peoples Media Project and Voces de Emigrantes en Resistencia on the struggle of Diné people.
This is Mutiado with Voces de Inmigrantes en Resistencia, One Struggle with the Diné People. In the month of November, we celebrate Native American Heritage Month, but also speak out on the ongoing genocide against Native American brothers and sisters in America. I had the opportunity to watch a documentary called Broken Rainbow on the struggle that's happening in Black Mesa and the Navajo Nation, where Peabody Coal Company is displacing and relocating Diné people to dig and rape Mother Earth for coal. I will share a short clip of the documentary called Broken Rainbow.
I'm here today to discuss the tragedy of relocating over 9,000 of my tribal people from the Diné homeland. More than 75% of the Navajo relocatees will be condemned to a life of misery, poverty, and alienation.
Just how would you have any income if you're forced to move? Do you have any other way of making a living other than livestock raising?
I make my living with the sheep. You don't have to carry them on your back, you just herd them. This is how I live. I will not relocate. If I were offered a new home, I would be a stranger in such a place. I wouldn't know how to operate the heating or the lighting system. Any expense, I'm sure, would be tremendous. How would I pay for these utilities? I have no income and have never been to any school.
Assuming we go through with this destructive effort, how and where would she be relocated on the Navajo reservation?
Senator DeConcini, there is no place on the present Navajo reservation to which she can relocate to carry on the way of life that she has described.
In the Navajo language, there is no word for relocation. To relocate is to disappear and never see again. In Black Mesa on the Navajo reservation, where many generations have come and passed, where 150,000 moons of praying have shaped and bound land and sky, where Diné people are being displaced and relocated for the sole reason the Black Mesa has the largest remaining deposit of coal in America, about 100 million of barrels of oil, 25 cubic feet of natural gas, 80 billions of pounds of uranium. We here in Poor Magazine is staying in the struggle with indigena gente to resist the genocide, the displacement of all indigena gente in the world. With Inmigrantes en Resistencia, this is Mutiado. This poem is dedicated for all the women that have carried the struggle from Michoacán to Navajo land. Asokoti, Sintlawi, purple corn reminds me of my grandma back in Michoacán land, showing me and my how to sing the songs of keeping the struggle alive, with beans and rice, with love and sacrifice, with patience and not waiting for the right time. Las tortillas a mano, just like you craft a movimiento, con cuidado, you need to know how. And even though I could hardly remember my grandma, because I was too young to recall, I taste the revolution on las tortillas de mi mamá. Y las rancheras de las Adelitas, Malcolm X, Cesar Chavez, Brown Berets, remind me of the rebel spirit that lives inside of our people, mi gente valiente, fighting for 500 years and counting.
To read the complete story and see the PNN TV interview with Danny Black Goat, go online to www.poormagazine.org and click on Indigenous Peoples Media Project. For more of Mutiado's great art, poetry, and writing, you can also click on Voces de Inmigrantes en Resistencia.
The formal education slam. All you brothers and sisters on the front lines, taking the bullets, taking the struggle, this is all for you. In light of the recent protests by students on campuses across Califas, Aslan, to the proposed tuition increases of 32% and beyond, Poor Magazine stands in solidarity with you. But we also want to remind you, as you struggle, as you take the batons and the other weapons of capitalism, to remember that formal institutions of learning have never been for us poor folk. And that, in fact, formal institutions of knowledge are only one form of knowledge that has unfairly cornered the market as the only form of valid education, while on our stolen land and with our stolen resources. And that those formal institutions of learning have been for rich people from the beginning. And when us poor people get in, it's by way of crumbs being thrown, aka scholarships and or loans that indebt us to them for the rest of our lives, for the sole privilege of attending universities on stolen land. So we at Poor Magazine urge you all on to continue that fight for access, but also encourage you to rethink education itself and its racist, classist, separatist tests and studies and obstacles that keep you out intentionally. All of you are welcome to come through to Poor Magazine's People School, which begins its winter semester with a knowledge exchange and art exchange we call Mercado de Cambio, or the Posto, on December 16th at Poor Magazine. One of the other infiltrations to formal institutions of learning and the racist classes publishing industry is Poor Press. And we are blessed with two authors today from Poor Press, both Mutiado and Riate Akio McLaughlin, a.k.a. Ram. So I'd like to have him speak his beautiful poem in honor of our indigenous journey to Southern Ute Bear Dance last summer. And then we'll talk about his book.
This poem is called Poor. We are evolutionary, like the white bison. Young in our crown anniversary, like Mike Tyson. See, we stand as tall as bears, but at times even we fall down. But we peeked across this turtle country, in metro cities, urban countrysides, and towns. Now we speak more than one tongue, can't barely understand-ish. Smartest person in the world knows that they know nothing. But to learn more, we ain't never gonna quit. You see, our journey never ends. We just took a sharp turn. The line was too straight, or we lit fires that didn't burn. But why are we forever poor in the richest country in the world? Well, when I did my graduation speech, I had an MC Hammer suit on with a Jerry curl. Thank you.
So Poor Press, which is the publishing arm of Poor Magazine, and actually has been in operation since 2003, publishing the work of poverty, race, migrant, disabled, elder, and youth scholars by any means necessary through all of our underground economic strategies that we pull. But I'd like to highlight the fact that this year, 2009, group of Poor Press includes seven authors, as well as Los Viajes anthology, which is a beautiful book, bilingual, that documents peoples crossing over Pachamama and introduces the UN Declaration on Indigenous Peoples. All of these books are available online at www.poormagazine.org and will also be available at the Mercado de Cambio. Riate, can you talk a little bit about your book and what is the title of the book that's being released this semester?
My book is called Complicated, and it's about being in love while in recovery. It has a lot to do with recovery because I was in a program, but I lost my ex-girlfriend at the time, and you know, falling out of love at it just brought a lot of pain. So it's very different than my first two books, which are strictly about recovery. This has to do with being in love in recovery.
And so it's a poetry book. Can you tell listeners what it means or why it's important for you to publish, why folks should support this?
The poetry that I write out of pain, and I don't want other people to have to go through the struggles that I go through. I'm still dealing with recovery, trying to be clean in recovery. My mother is a graduate and counselor of a drug program, so that's more inspiration for me also. But I'm just trying to help people so they can read some of my poetry and not make the mistakes, not travel down those lonely road, because it only leads to death, jails, and institutions.
Powerful scholarship, and I want to say that Poor Press is actually a micro-business strategy for all us poverty scholars, because the proceeds of every book goes back to each author. And again, this is a powerful project at Poor that's unsupported, unfunded by any philanthropy pimps. And yes, I did say pimps. Anyway, so people should check us out or support us. You can get the books online. It's an interesting and very powerful gift in this in these crazy holidays where people be putting out all kinds of capitalist dollars for all kinds of things that don't matter. So check us out, and also think about coming through to our Mercado de Cambio, our Posto, on December 16th at Poor Magazine, 2940 16th Street in San Francisco, one block below the 16th Street BART. We will be presenting a knowledge exchange with a powerful scholar, Jose Cuellar, who comes from formal institutions of learning back down to the community where he started, along with the Poetas Pobres, the Poor Press authors, the Welfare Queens, and the scholars on lived experience, who will be actually presenting our own form of knowledge as well. So again, that's on December 16th, all day long, holiday market, Mercado de Cambio, Market of Change, at Poor Magazine. For more information, you can go online to www.poormagazine.org and click on Mercado de Cambio, the Posto, or you can call us at 415-863-6306. But that is Wednesday, December 16th, from noon to 9 p.m., a full day. And so I just wanted to also give a shout-out to, again, our ancestors and our fellow scholars who are now on their spirit journey, Andrea Lewis and Cassandra Yazzi. Thank you for all your work and your time and your love.
So that's all for this month's broadcast in honor of Native American Heritage Month of Poor News Network on KPFA's morning show at 94.1 FM. Thanks to One Struggle for their amazing Native hip-hop, Mari Villaluna, for her work as Indigenous Peoples Media Coordinator at Poor Magazine, and blessings to our sister Cassandra Yazzie on her spirit journey. As well, thanks to Esther Mania for her editing work. For more info on POR's programs, call us at 415-863-6306 or tune in next month for the next broadcast of POR News Network.
It's funny how money changes situations.
Money does change the situation. But you know what? I'm going to make my holiday gifts this year. 8 o'clock on the dot here on the morning show. It's November 30th. I'm Amy Allison. Right after the news, it's a shadow elite. The same old names, Larry Summer, Tom Geithner, and all the rest keep popping up, representing a new elite that's undermining our democracy, according to Janelle Widell. So stay tuned for that right after the news. It's KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online all the time at KPFA.org. Now it's time for the news with Eileen Alfandari. Good morning.
Good morning, Amy. The U.S. Supreme Court has overturned an appeals court ruling ordering the disclosure of photographs of detainees being abused by their U.S. captors. The High Court cited a recent change in federal law that allows the pictures to be withheld. The justices issued a brief order directing the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York to take another look at a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union to obtain the photos of detainee torture and abuse. President Obama at first did not oppose the release, but after intense internal pressure changed his mind, saying the photos could whip up anti-U.S. sentiment overseas and endanger U.S. troops. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from California death row inmate Kevin Cooper. Cooper came within a few hours of execution in 2004 before the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals stepped in to order genetic testing on a hair and a bloody shirt found at the murder scene that Cooper said would prove he was not the killer. The San Francisco-based appeals court later backed a district judge's ruling that the test results did not show Cooper's innocence, but that same judge noted that a detective lost, destroyed, or left unpursued important evidence in the case. The criminologist in charge of the evidence turned out to be a heroin addict who was later fired for stealing drugs seized by police. Crystal Bybee is with the Kevin Cooper Defense Committee. She noted this morning that one of the dissenting appeals court justices had warned the state of California could be about to execute an innocent man. She and Cooper's advocates had hoped the Supreme Court would agree to hear his case.
We had hoped that the Supreme Court would hear the appeal because of the overwhelming evidence, first of all, of Kevin Cooper's innocence and the continued revelations about what the prosecutors and the state have done to the evidence and to keep him in prison. We also hoped that they would hear the case based on the very severe constitutional violations that happened in his court. The prosecutors are not allowed to destroy, to withhold, and to manipulate evidence. And that is exactly what they did.
You noted that the decision by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that was upheld by the Supreme Court today was a divided one.
It was bitterly divided. The Ninth Circuit decision, Kevin came within a few votes of winning that appeal. And the dissent that was written in the Ninth Circuit case, I highly encourage people to read it because it is 100 pages of the facts, the story, and what the state has done to Kevin Cooper. And I would challenge anyone to walk away from that not believing that Kevin Cooper is an innocent man.
Crystal Bybee with the Kevin Cooper Defense Committee and the campaign to end the death penalty. The U.S. Senate today begins debate on the health care reform bill, but signs of division are clear in the crucial Democratic support that will be needed to pass the measure. Some Democratic senators want tighter restrictions on abortion coverage, like the restrictions included in the House bill. Others say they'll bolt if the government insurance public option is included. Liberal senators say they won't vote for a bill without the public option, and no Republicans are likely to cross party lines. Today marks a day of action for global climate justice. Rallies, marches, and civil disobedience are planned around the U.S. and the world. In San Francisco, there's an 11:30 a.m. rally at Justin Herman Plaza, followed by a march to Bank of America. Organizers say that, as with protests against the World Trade Organization 10 years ago in Seattle, Seattle, the climate justice movement is focusing on unaccountable corporate power. Gopal Dianeni is with Movement Generation.
We need a funds-based mechanism for financing both mitigation for future carbon emissions and adaptation to the impacts of climate change that we know are already coming, as opposed to a market-based system in which corporations like Bank of America and others have the right to make money off of the buying and selling of the right to pollute our air. We need the transfer of technology, clean technologies from the global north to the global south.
KPFA will preview today's actions on the morning show at 8:30 a.m. We'll have a full wrap-up of the day's events on the evening news at 6. At the Global Climate Summit, host country Denmark may urge the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2050 from 1990 levels. Reuters News Service said it saw an advanced text of the Danish position. The document says rich countries should account for 80% of global emission reductions. Danish officials, though, said there are a variety of draft text proposals floating around. Honduras remains divided a day after disputed presidential elections. Hondurans who went to the polls elected conservative rancher Porfirio Lobo, who said his main task is uniting the country. His remarks were translated by English Al Jazeera.
We want to establish a national dialogue and invite all sectors of the population without excluding anyone. I'm sure we will reach an understanding through dialogue. The country's interest must come before any particular interest.
But supporters of ousted President Manuel Zelaya boycotted the polls and no pro-Zelaya candidate ran for election. Zelaya urged the U.S. not to follow through with its plan to recognize the election.
We Central Americans don't want to return to the wars of the 80s. We don't want Iraq or Afghanistan-style elections. If they are Democrats in the States, they should be Democrats for Latin America.
Zelaya remains at the Brazilian embassy where he's been sheltering for weeks. The U.S. and Canada have said they will recognize the election. Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela have said they won't. A Russian minister visiting Iran said there's still a chance for negotiations to resolve the West's objections to Iran's nuclear program. The Russian minister's comment is seen as an attempt to defuse the latest flare-up. Iran's nuclear chief said a critical United Nations report is pushing Iran toward developing even more nuclear facilities. The International Atomic Energy Agency adopted a resolution Friday demanding Iran halt all enrichment activities. France, meanwhile, pressed for new sanctions against Iran, saying diplomacy isn't working. The U.S. and its allies fear Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons. Iran says its program is peaceful. A top Swiss official says voter approval of a ban on minarets next to mosques could be struck down in court. The country's justice minister said the referendum would come into force immediately, but indicated it could be overturned. The referendum was backed by more than 57% of voters. Swiss government officials had campaigned against the ban on new minarets. The United Nations Special Investigator on Religious Freedom said the ban constitutes clear discrimination against Muslims in Switzerland. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, highs in the lower to mid 60s in Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy dense morning fog, high 61 to 66 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. I'll have more news at 8:30. You're listening to The Morning Show on KPFA.
This month, Golden Thread Productions presents Reorient 2009, The First 10 Years, a festival of short plays exploring the Middle East. This one-of-a-kind festival turns the Bay Area into a mecca for innovative, spirited, and thought-provoking theater from around the world, providing a rare opportunity for artists and audiences alike to engage deeply and directly with the Middle East in a creative and supportive setting that displaces misinformation and encourages understanding. This year, Golden Thread celebrates the festival's 10th anniversary by featuring a world premiere by MacArthur Genius Award winner Naomi Wallace, as well as a retrospective of plays from the festival's past 10 years. The festival runs through to December 13th at the Thick House in San Francisco. Please visit Golden Thread's website for all the latest programming and ticketing information at goldenthread.org. This is a KPFA-sponsored event.
10 after 8 on your Monday morning, November 30th, as we're winding back up on the after a long holiday. Unless you're in retail, then you had no holiday. 10 after 8, I'm Amy Allison on the morning show. And, you know, professor of public policy at George Mason University and anthropologist Janine Waddell now joins us. Her new book is called The Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. Janine, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, I had to say, you know, we open up USA Today and we look at their front page article, how some retired military officers become well-paid consultants. This is exactly what you're talking about. The same group of elites who have, you know, in the military in this case, have their hands on opinion makers, too.
Exactly. And the problem is, I mean, the story that was exposed a week and a half ago on the front pages of USA Today, as you said, is about a Pentagon program of retired military officers who served as, quote unquote, senior mentors to the armed forces, while at the same time also working for defense contractors and at the same time drawing pensions. And the way these mentors are selected, who their defense clients actually are, and in fact they're hired by they're working formally for government contractors, not directly for the government, and their levels of pay are all sort of locked away in a black box beyond government and public scrutiny. But unfortunately, this is not unusual. These kinds of opaque practices are infuse much of federal governance today. This is really a logical product of the way that governing has been reconstituted in the United States in recent decades.
I was going to ask you about that because your book Shadow Elite says that there's an elite that has their hands in foreign and domestic policy, the financial system, as well as opinion makers, and they move through these different roles.
Exactly. And one of the big problems is that we seem to be able to change the government, change administrations, but we have the same players who seem to pop up wherever the action is, regardless of the administration that's in power. And this reminds me very much of what I saw in Eastern Europe and Russia 20 years ago after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when you had these self-interested informal networks that emerged between state and private to fill the governing vacuum. And sometimes they were operating in the public interest, but very often they weren't. And so, I mean, what seems to be happening here is reminiscent in many ways. I mean, just consider, for example, that the Wall Street government policy deciders who have come to be symbolized by government facts seem very familiar to me. They seem like the clans that emerged in Russia in the 1990s to control state-owned property which was being privatized and resources.
Is that really there? We're talking about Larry Summers and the Timothy Geithner and those folks.
Well, I think what the parallel is, and of course these players are operating under very, very different circumstances, and it's important to keep that in mind. But at the heart of these issues is that it's that the players themselves have the information and other people don't. And their workings are largely beyond the reach of government monitors and the public. And so gone are the messy disagreements and competing interests of the democratic process. And at the heart of this crisis really is a crisis of loyalty. Think about those who ruined Enron. It was a lack of loyalty to institutions, including the dearth of regard for shareholders and boards of directors that really characterizes this whole this whole crisis. So the point is, they have the information, they can brand it for us, and we can't really know what's going on. And that's exactly what was happening in a completely different sphere with these retired military officers serving as senior mentors. But I mean, Representative Murtha, who chairs the Defense Subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee, said that his committee, which is responsible for this, had never heard of the Pentagon mentoring program, responsible in the sense that it's the committee that would have oversight over it. It had never heard of it. So
that's hard to believe. I mean, there's nothing illegal about those arrangements, right?
Exactly. There's nothing illegal about any of these arrangements, and that's one of the striking features of this new system of power and influence that we have evolved into this country and more generally. It's not just going on here. But these players are really a logical product of the way that governing has been reconstituted in recent decades. I mean, in this country, in the United States, much of governance now takes place outside of formal government. 3/4 of people working for the U.S. government get their paychecks from private companies instead of from the federal government.
Is that
directly?
Because the government's been privatized over the last couple of decades?
Because there's so much of contracting out to private firms, to businesses, to think tanks, NGOs, universities, and so on. So those are people are doing the work of, and I'm talking about federal government. They're doing more of it than people who are actually formally federal employees.
And you call this new, you know, I'm looking at your book, The Shadow Elite, and you call this kind of new breed of influencers, I guess including those high-ranking military officers as well as other folks, these flexians. You give them that term. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're flexians because they're very flexible in their arrangements. They break the rules both of the state. Those would be the rules of accountability, right? And they also test the rules of the market. Those would be the rules of competition. I mean, I was taught that the quintessence of a free market was competition. But these players circumvent both businesses' rules of competition and government's rules of accountability in order to accomplish their goals. And this means that they can't be reduced. They're not simply working for state or private entities or bureaucracy or market. Their impact actually comes from their ability to blend and blur the roles across these divides. And they can't be usually pinned down to any single professional role or organization. So they're in the organizations, in government, business, think tanks, and across national borders, but they're seldom of them. And they're always working on behalf of their own agenda or behalf of the agendas of the networks that they belong to. So they can be loyal to a network, but they're seldom loyal to institutions unless they set them up. That is, the loyalty to the network trumps the loyalty to the institutions. And very often, this is not just about money, because sometimes they're spending taxpayer money, sometimes they're not, but it's about public policy and their ability to craft and get their public policies instituted without checks and balances.
I mean, do you feel like with the Shadow Elite that you're uncovering a rogue group of individuals who have shifting allegiances and who have unchecked power? Is that really what this is about?
Well, I wouldn't describe them. Yes, I mean, it's a group of people that actually their allegiances are not shifting, even though they're working across institutions. They have the same agenda, and the thing is, they use this agenda. They use these institutions to further their agendas, and those agendas may be ideological. And they're always about public policy, and they're always involved in crafting public public policy. So their allegiances they have very, very strong allegiances, but it's not usually to the government or to the business that they're involved in. They're using that in order to get the agenda of their group put across. I wouldn't describe them quite as rogue, because they are the people many of whose names we know, many of their names we don't know, but they're in the news, and they're the people that we listen to all the time. I mean, if you consider for a moment a story that came out in the New York Times, for which the journalist won a Pulitzer a year ago, it was about 50, again, retired military people who were publicly talking about the conduct of the Iraq War in the media constantly, while at the same time they were getting undisclosed perks and briefings on the subject from the Pentagon that was ostensibly hoping to shape their opinions. And this information about these generals came out, but it came out well after the fact. And while millions of viewers and Congress and General Petraeus, these people were also talking to testifying before Congress and meeting with generals, the most important ones, were led to believe that these retired military officers were offering their unbiased opinions. In fact, their interlocking roles in the media, in business, and in the Pentagon, and unannounced roles created incentives for them to be less than impartial.
Well,
so the issue is we can't really know. We're in the dark.
We're in the dark. Well, talk about, in your book, you wrote about Stephen Kelman. He's not even a familiar name to most people, but he's one of those folks who say who's shifting roles over the last couple of decades has made him quite influential.
Right. Well, and he was particularly influential in some of the changing legislation in the 1990s when he worked for the Clinton administration in changing some of the laws ostensibly to streamline government contracting. And it did that to some extent, but in fact what we have now are these mega contracts, which are much more convoluted, so that if a government agency needs contractors, it goes to one of these mega contracts and hires those contractors, but very often the people that those contractors report to is a completely different government agency. Right, so it would be like instead of you reporting to KPFA, you're reporting to, say, another radio station. What sort of then influence would your radio station really have? It's that sort of arrangement that's been ushered in, and that's part of the problem. That's part of the issue that we have in federal governing today. It's not just that there's so much more so much more contracting out of government functions. It's also that the rules of contracting have been changed, and there's a lot more untransparent networking that goes on behind the scenes among government officials and contractors. And I have a project at the New America Foundation funded by the Ford Foundation, and one of the things that we've seen in looking at many reports from the Government Accountability Office and Inspectors General of various agencies is that government investigators have raised questions in report after report about who drives policy. Is it government or contractors? And whether government has the information, expertise, and institutional memory to even manage contractors, or is it the other way around? And keep in mind that these contractors are doing, many of them are doing government functions. They choose and oversee other contractors. They control crucial databases. They draft official documents, and they run intelligence operations. They actually constitute 1/4 of the country's intelligence workforce. Government bailouts and stimulus packages are managed and overseen by contractor firms.
And let me stop you right there,
mm-hmm,
because
sure,
Larry Summers and Tim Geithner are two of the architects really influential in the whole bailout and the domestic policies relates to government management and bailout of the financial system. They're
right.
Two of those folks you're talking about, the shadow elite.
Right, and I think that the issue, what we have to be really aware of, is that it's a small interlocking group. We don't know exactly what they're up to, and the point is we can't know because it's a small interlocking group that has its hands in deeply in certain Wall Street firms and in the government, and we can't really know where their loyalties truly are and what's going on behind the scenes. And yet, you know, billions and billions of dollars have been allocated, and the future of the whole, you know, financial sector is at least to some extent in the hands of these kinds of players, this kind of interlocking quite closed group of people. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily bad people or that they're ill-intentioned, but
you're not saying that. I guess what I drew from the book is that they are
right.
Ill-intentioned. I mean, they're suspect agendas. They wear many hats. It's not clear where their loyalties are.
Right.
It's not clear if they're serving the public, even if they get paid on the public dime.
That's right.
It sounds like they're not. They're up to no good, or they have undue influence.
They have undue influence. The point is that, you know, gone are the messy disagreements and competing interests of democratic process. I mean, their workings are largely beyond the reach of traditional monitors. So we're a democratic society, but how do we know what's going on, right? So that is at the heart of the issue. They're not necessarily unethical, but they're beyond our ability to see what's going on. And once you go there in a democratic society, it's a downward trajectory.
I mean, I know you look in your book at what happened mm-hmm. after the wall fell in Germany, and you look at the lessons from Europe. When you say it's a downward trajectory, what are we going to see based on history?
Well, that's very hard to know, but I think that more and more what used to be in the public domain, decisions that used to be more open are less so. I mean, the new elite is less visible. This shadow elite is less visible. It's much more peripatetic. It's much harder to spot than previous sorts of elite. These players are less stable. They move around a lot. They're more elastic in their engagements, and they're more global in reach than their forebears. And they also specialize in branding the information they have for the media and the public in today's, you know, society culture where appearances are everything and appearances of the moment seem to be so important. So they're much more difficult to detect than the equivalent players, power brokers of the previous previous era in recent history, at least. And that, I think, is what is especially dangerous in a democratic society, because again, it's not necessarily that players who fit this profile are doing bad things. It's that we really can't know what they're doing, or we really don't know, and we're not as well equipped to really read between the lines of what's going on as people who, say, grew up in communist societies. They had to read between the lines because they knew that what they were watching on TV and what they were reading in the newspapers was not true. So they had to, you know, they developed some abilities to to be critical and scrutinizing of what they heard and read. And I think in the United States, this is our public, our people really need to begin to develop these kinds of skills, because otherwise we're going to be seduced by these very effective, very suave, players who are very good at presenting themselves in the media.
Well, what should happen then? I mean, what your book says, recognize this new breed of players, understand this new system, but what are you advocating should be done?
Well, standard means of accountability, the kinds of traditional audits that government does, they're important, but they're largely focused on, say, taxpayer money, how taxpayer money are spent. And of course, that's crucial. But these players are working on the policy end of things. They're crafting and influencing and sometimes making public and implementing public policy. So we need to begin to think about systems of monitoring and auditing that are as peripatetic as these players. These players are not stable. They move around. They're elastic. They're global in reach than their forebears. I mean, this is a very difficult problem. I do not have any easy prescriptions. This problem is so fundamental that it doesn't lend itself to an easy and complex. It doesn't lend itself to an easy prescription.
But perhaps the first step, right? Perhaps the first step, Professor Waddell, is just recognizing the shadow elite is here and has been operating in all of these spheres. Well, thank you very much, Professor, for joining us.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Janine Waddell is author of Shadow Elite, actually coming out tomorrow, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. Well, right after the news, the World Trade Organization protests are heating up, and we look back at what happened in Seattle that really changed the map and put local organizing on the international scale. Brian Edwards-Tiekert has that story right after the news.
The White House spokesperson says President Barack Obama held an unannounced meeting on the Afghan war last night with members of his war council. Robert Gibbs says Obama met with Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, National Security Advisor Jim Jones, and others to lay out his final decision for the Afghan war, which is expected to include sending tens of thousands more U.S. troops. Gibbs said Obama contacted French President Nicolas Sarkozy and would be in touch later with the British Prime Minister and the Russian President. The U.S. Supreme Court has overturned an appeals court ruling ordering the disclosure of photographs of detainees being abused by their U.S. captors. The High Court cited a recent change in federal law that allows the pictures to be withheld. The American Civil Liberties Union had filed suit to obtain the photos of detainee torture and abuse. The Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from California death row inmate Kevin Cooper. Cooper came within a few hours of execution in 2004 before the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals stepped in to order genetic testing on a hair and a bloody shirt found at the murder scene that Cooper said would prove he wasn't the killer. A divided appeals court later backed a district judge's ruling that the test results did not show Cooper's innocence. But that same judge noted that a detective lost, destroyed, or left unpursued important evidence in Cooper's case. Honduras remains divided a day after disputed presidential elections. Hondurans who went to the polls elected conservative Ranger Porfirio Lobo, but supporters of ousted President Manuel Zelaya boycotted the election, and no pro-Zelaya candidate ran for the vote. The U.S. and Canada have said they'll recognize the election. Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela have said they won't. At the Global Climate Summit, host country Denmark may urge the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2050 from 1990 levels. Reuters News Service said it saw an advanced text of the Danish position. That document said rich countries should account for 80% of global emission reductions. Danish officials said there are a number of draft text proposals under consideration. Today marks a day of action for global climate justice. Rallies, marches, and civil disobedience are planned around the U.S. and the world. In San Francisco, there's an 11:30 a.m. rally at Justin Herman Plaza, followed by a march to Bank of America. More on today's actions coming up on the morning show in just a moment. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny with highs in the lower to mid-60s, and Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy dense morning fog, high 61 to 66 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. I'll have more news at 10 a.m. on Letters to Washington. Then we'll have headlines at noon, Free Speech Radio News at 3:30, headlines at 4. Please join us at 6 for the hour-long edition of the evening news. You are listening to The Morning Show on KPFA.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending December 13th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. On Thursday, December 10th at 5:30 p.m., the Center for Employment Training will hold a special workshop for elderly candidates applying for U.S. citizenship at 701 Vine Street in San Jose. This workshop is free. For more information, call 408-534-5215. On Saturday, December 12th at 11 a.m., El Cerrito's Environmental Quality Committee will present Who Killed the Electric Car at 10070 San Pepo Avenue in El Cerrito. This event is free. For more information, call 510-523-1737. On Saturday, December 12th and Sunday, December 13th, one of the oldest indie craft fairs in the nation, Bazaar Bizarre, will take place at the San Francisco County Fair Building in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. Admission is $2 for adults. Children 12 and under are free. For more information, call 415-664-1267. The community calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA, Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California 94704, or fax them to 510-848-3812, or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Attention to the community calendar. Please tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
.836 in the morning here at KPFA, and 10 years ago, this day, here is what it sounded like in the streets of Seattle, Washington.
Everybody's asking all these questions, what is the WTO, how does it affect me? It's everything they're eating, everything they're wearing, everything they're watching, everything they're hearing.
What do you mean shut it down?
Well, right now we're blockading the entranceway that most of the delegates are trying to get in. So we're literally trying to shut down the meeting.
Every street that leads to the convention center has a corner blocked off.
As the World Trade Organization launched a round of talks that were supposed to radically expand its scope, there was a massive revolt in the negotiations and in the streets. The protest brought together a coalition of U.S. environmentalists, labor unions, and social justice groups from developing nations. Many adopted militant tactics, physically blockading the convergence center where talks were to take place, and pushing back the police where they tried to break through. The protest dominated headlines, and the faces of the protest were, by and large, young people, leading pundits to announce the birth of a new, young movement for global justice. So, 10 years later, where are those coalitions and where is that movement? Joining me to answer that question is Ananda Litan. Today he works as the U.S. and Canada coordinator for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. Back then he was organizing Canadian forest workers to participate in the protests. Good morning.
Morning.
And with us by telephone we have Antonia Yuhas, author most recently of The Tyranny of Oil. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Ananda, let's start with you. You were right in the middle of the fabled blue-green coalition that emerged in Seattle. Paint me a picture of what happened when you brought Canadian tree planters to the WTO talks.
Well, it was really a culmination of a lot of different movements coming together. For us, coming down to Seattle, we had about 4,000 strong labor union rank-and-file members, environmental and anti-poverty activists, and various activists that had been for a number of years really hashing out some of the frontline fights between economics and ecosystems and jobs. And really it came down to understanding that trade liberalization or market liberalization organization was really driving a lot of our resources out of our community and undermining, you know, the economic stability of our communities up in Ganda. So when we organized rank and file workers to come down, it was on the pretext of opposing the corporations that were using the trade arena to ship our logs out of our communities and undermine our jobs by undermining, you know, the social systems in Canada. Coming to Seattle, I guess the epiphany for me and many others was that that we shared a common cause with campesina, you know, peasants and farm workers from around the world, fisher folk and various other frontline communities that were fighting the same root causes of the decline of their communities in this corporate control. I think the follow-up epiphany was that public opposition really did make a difference, coming to the streets of Seattle and watching a lot of the well-organized activists there shut down the actual the trade talks at the WTO made a lot of us realize that street heat can make a difference. And in the lead up following Seattle, of course, with the Doha round being derailed by massive public protests around the world by farmers and fisherfolk forcing their governments to take up a strong stance against this corporate control, I think has really served to empower workers in the years since.
I want to turn to you, Antonio Juhans. You've been involved both with many of the non-governmental organizations trying to change the course of globalization and with the direct action movement in this country. What do you think some of the victories of the global justice movement have been since Seattle?
I think maybe the first thing to say is, in Seattle, I was with American Lands Alliance, also working most focused on forest protection issues, actually, and the environmental policies of the World Trade Organization, and organizing for about 2 years to try and bring people from all around the world and all across the United States to Seattle to participate in whatever way made sense for them, from direct action on the street to inside the negotiations to working with the press, to just make clear. I mean, our biggest goal in some ways in the lead up to Seattle was just having people know what the World Trade Organization was, and understand its significance, and then understand its policies, and bring people that awareness in the North when that awareness is already so strong, particularly in the Global South. And I had been part of a group called the Preamble Center for Public Policy, working against the Multilateral Agreement on Investment in the years leading up to Seattle. And that was really the first global international trade or investment agreement that was derailed by citizen activism, putting pressure on governments to reject a corporate agreement. And then it was when the corporate advocates of the Multilateral Agreement on Investment suggested that it should be picked up again at the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999, that entire global movement was able to help focus and join in on opposition to the talks. And it really just created this North and South unity that hadn't been nearly that strong addressing issues of corporate globalization prior to that moment. And so while we were described in Seattle as the quote-unquote birth of a new movement, it was really the moment when people in the United States became aware of a struggle that had been organizing and winning for many years against institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and then it really came in a powerful way to the WTO in 1999 in Seattle. And it was a real awakening for many activists, including myself. As you said, I had worked with NGOs. I had worked on Capitol Hill for two members of Congress. I had been involved in many protests, but I'd never been involved in anything like what happened in Seattle. And I think for many people to see the violence of the response of the state to our 99.9% nonviolent civil disobedience and the global presence on the streets was really a big awakening to
really our capacity to create change with the level of pushback that would be brought to us. And I think it also brought all of us who organized around Seattle closer through those experiences. And
let's take a second to dig into that. One of the images that came out of Seattle, among many, was the images of a small group of protesters wearing black hooded sweatshirts, smashing Starbucks windows, clashing with riot cops decked out in gear that made them look like Darth Vader. Do you think that actually served the movement well to have that be one of the dominant images?
Well, I think that, you know, clearly the dominant violence that happened in Seattle was definitely police and state violence by far. I actually started off the morning in the emergency room from the get-go and watched on television with horror with everyone else in the emergency room when we saw police officers turning their guns on nonviolent protesters. We thought they were guns holding bullets. Fortunately, it turned out after they fired that it was guns holding tear gas and rubber bullets. But nobody knew that, and that's how the day started. And then there were these instances of people breaking windows with bricks. And, you know, I think that was one of the dominant images, but the most prominent response to Seattle was this question of what is the WTO, why is there so much opposition to it, and oh my God, this civil disobedience had a dramatic and lasting impact on the decision-making of one of the most powerful institutions in the world.
Antonio Guhas, I want you to stay with us. We're going to go to Geneva right now, where there have been protests underway against the latest ministerial-level talks at the WTO. They haven't gotten as much press in this country, but news reports say up to 5,000 people have participated in the protests. There have been clashes with police, some cars lit on fire, some stores smashed. All accounts say the vast majority of the protesters are peaceful. And Olivier de Marcellis, who is active with People's Global Action, joins us now by cell phone from the streets of Geneva. Good morning and good evening.
Good morning. Good evening here. Actually, I'm right in the middle of a protest right now with Via Campesina, the International Farmers Organization, who wanted to do a candlelight ceremony to remember the death of the Korean farmer Lee, who committed suicide, as you know, in front of WTO in Cancun. Unfortunately, the police don't seem to even respect that because they pushed us back across the street. But generally speaking, the demonstrations here have been a great success. Much more people than we thought. Certainly the resistance is still there. People still know that WTO is a really bad, bad story.
Olivier de Marcellis, I understand that you are helping to organize a caravan from the Geneva protests to the Copenhagen Climate Summit, which is coming up in a week. Why connect those two?
Excuse me? What? The climate caravan, yes. We organized the climate caravan because it was very evident to the networks working on WTO as much as the networks working for the climate summit. So these are totally linked because what Copenhagen is trying to do, what a lot of multinationals and governments, unfortunately, are trying to do in Copenhagen is to turn it into actually something to do with trade and nothing to do with the climate, albeit market solutions, developing agrofuels in the south and thereby taking away hundreds of thousands of acres of land from small farmers, deforestation. Basically, what is liable to happen in Copenhagen is just to go on with the politics of WTO and aggressive globalization, basically merchandising the rest of the world. So very quickly, it became evident that the same people who wanted to come to WTO wanted also to go to Copenhagen. So we proposed to organize this caravan, which is going to take 60 members of the Global South, representatives of the Global South, from in two buses from Geneva to Copenhagen.
All right. Well, Olivier de Marcellis, thanks so much for speaking with us. Good luck to you, and please stay safe out there.
Great. 10 years after, the resistance is still there.
All right. Olivier de Marcellus is active with People's Global Action. He's helping to organize the caravan from the WTO protests currently underway in Geneva to the Copenhagen Climate Summit scheduled for Copenhagen, taking place beginning on Monday. Ananda, I want to turn back to you. One of the critiques that's emerged about the coalition that gathered in Seattle 10 years ago was that it became too focused on these meetings. It turned into a group of conference hoppers.
Yes, well, one of the, I guess to reflect a bit back on our global justice movement, one of the lessons, I think, takeaway lessons from Seattle was that we really needed to build our movement, like Antonia referred to earlier, really develop a stronger grassroots analysis of corporate control through these various arenas. And so some parts of the movement did really do good community movement building work after that and make these issues relevant to their communities, like one of our efforts back, taking Seattle back to Canada, was to really make forced workers aware how NAFTA and other multilateral trade agreements were serving to create more of an export-based economy, though shipping our natural resources out of our communities and with very little benefit to the actual workers and communities themselves. And I think part of the distraction of these conferences, the conference chasing or conference hopping, as you referred to, is that a lot of civil society time and resources are spent going to these events, protesting at these events, while not enough time is spent building the movement back at home. So while the protests are going to start in Copenhagen a week from now, a number of us are staying behind here in the U.S. to ensure that we have actions at home confronting these major corporate climate polluters, their financiers, and the carbon traders, as Olivier mentioned, who are taking advantage of this climate policy arena to really further, to both protect the status quo in terms of corporate profits and corporate control, but also really open new opportunities for themselves in terms of financing and investment opportunities in the developing world. So we're having actions all across the U.S. today in nine different cities across the U.S. and a couple of cities in Canada on the anniversary of Seattle under the coalition called the Mobilization for Climate Justice. And we've come together with the leadership of communities that are on the front lines of this climate fight, communities like the community in Richmond who are fighting the Chevron oil refinery, communities in Appalachia who are fighting Mount Top removal, coal mining communities throughout the country fighting coal power plants, people whose voices aren't represented at these conferences like Copenhagen or the WTO, and whose priorities need to be first and foremost in any kind of a sustainable solution for climate stabilization. So this is a call out to folks around the country to please do plug in. You can get more information at actforclimatejustice.org. If you're here in the Bay Area, our rally starts at Justin Herman Plaza at 11:30 a.m. and we proceed from there to Bank of America, one of the largest financiers of both the oil and gas sector but other climate polluting industries as well. And we hope folks will join us today.
Antonia Guhas, one of the questions I've wrestled with, 10 years ago, the protest against the WTO in Seattle, you had this incredibly broad, diverse coalition that was all against the same thing. They didn't want the WTO to expand on the terms that the developed world's leadership was talking about. Now that we're facing the Copenhagen Climate Summit, there's a problem that everyone wants addressed. And I guess the question facing me is, instead of having a broad coalition against something, can you gather a similarly broad coalition in favor of something in particular?
Well, I think that has happened, and there's been a tremendous amount of work towards that since Seattle. It was a criticism coming out of Seattle. I actually don't think it's a deserved criticism. I think that we do have very clear things we need to be against and we need to stop them, and it's important to maintain that messaging. Otherwise, all of the onus moves away from corporations and institutions that are putting forward problematic policies, and the onus then turns completely on the activist to say, well, what is it that you're organizing for exclusively? And the onus shifts, the responsibility shifts. And we need both. We need both points of responsibility addressed and taken care of, stopping the bad and proposing the good. And there's been a tremendous amount of organizing at the local level in particular, because what we don't want to actually do
is say we want to replace one set of global rules with an alternative set of global rules that are one size fits all. There are certain instances where that makes sense. For example, in the climate negotiations, there are certainly standards that we have to apply to the entire world. But one of the things that we've also learned looking at what's happening in the United States, for example, with the Congress so hamstringing the ability of President Obama to really move aggressively in Copenhagen and trying to get him to prove his independence from Congress and move more aggressively in Copenhagen, is that we have to maintain, for example, here, the ability of states to individually act to be more ahead of the federal government if the federal government's going to be more behind. We have to enhance the ability of localities to move ahead of the state if the state's going to stay behind. And we learned that we needed to support and address the diversity of solutions that are actually our commitment, as opposed to a one-size-fits-all, here are the alternatives for the world to replace the one-size-fits-all proposals that the institutions we were fighting were putting forward.
Concretely, how do you do that? If you are a movement, it implies some amount of unity. So how do you unify around a diverse and geographically dispersed set of local initiatives?
Well, that is a struggle. That has been the hard part. I mean, I think, you know, what has time and again since the global justice movement has really been organizing, it is obviously much more simple to come together around global points of opposition while we then return home and work in support of positive alternatives. And there's a real set of support for the environment, support for climate justice, support for diversity, equality, and we have, you know, a pretty clear set of interests that are very clearly opposite of those that are being put forward through the global institutions. And we've written, you know, I was part of a process for writing a book called Alternatives to Economic Globalization, which laid out some core principles and went into them in depth. We have a lot of those. But at the sort of heart of our organizing is the idea of, you know, different places are going to do it differently and are going to need to meet different targets and different objectives.
Mm. Natalie Tan, I want to turn back to you. We have just a couple minutes left, but you came to Seattle 10 years ago working with a very specific constituency, tree planters in Canada. You described earlier in this segment how their political awareness was expanded by participating in the protest. Where did that energy go after Seattle?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what had started out long before Seattle was really building what became eventually the Labour Environmental Alliance. That was a lot of very progressive trade unionists, sort of labour organizers, environmental activists who had been involved in the forest defence fight in the Northwest, and had come together to really resolve their localized differences and really chart a path for those localized solutions that you were referring to recently. That really then took us in the direction of tenure reform, where these massive corporations were dominating the forest in Northern Canada.
Tenure being the land ownership structure,
exactly.
Not how faculty hang on to their jobs
exactly.
At universities. Okay.
Yes. So the tenure that the corporations, multinational corporations, had been awarded in exchange for a social contract, which they were gradually eroding and were further eroding through NAFTA and other bilateral agreements. In this case, we had to re-examine people's relationship to the land, and I think that that dialogue opened us up to the fact that we, in order to win the local fight, we also had to stand up for the rights of others in our neighboring communities, like Indigenous people. So a lot of trade union movements through that time, and today the Canadian Labour Congress actually is one of the few national organizations that supports the rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada to free, prior, and informed consent, a core issue in the climate talks. But it's interesting, while the government of Canada and other governments like New Zealand, Australia, and the U.S. oppose them at the UN, the various national labor federations have come to support them. And this has happened as a result of this dialogue and understanding the issues of our fellow struggles and really understanding that that those locally identified solutions had to be consistent and couldn't be at the cost of communities elsewhere. And when seeking those, what I call a translocal strategy, part of the dialogue is really understanding where our, you know, we need to support those locally defined priorities and solutions without any cost to other communities elsewhere in the world.
Antonio, we have about 30 seconds to wrap up. Any lessons from 10 years ago for the people organizing for Copenhagen today?
Just the power of the organizing, the power of our movements. I mean, I think that, this question that you've ended with is the most important question. It's the dialectic between the local and the global. And we have to come up with global solutions to local problems and vice versa. And that we're still, still learning. And I think, Copenhagen, this moment is a key moment, in addressing the bads. So we've got local organizing today, right now, on local corporations. Again on December 7th, with the target being Chevron, the largest greenhouse gas emitter in the entire state of California, but also ongoing organizing for the positive solutions that we hope everyone will be a part of.
Well, Antonio Juhas, thanks for joining us. Antonio Juhas is Director of Chevron Programs at Global Exchange, author most recently of The Tyranny of Oil, and she gets 10 points for using the word dialectic in a radio interview. Ananda Lee Tan also spoke with us. He is currently the Canadian and U.S. Programs Director for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. He was working with Canadian forest workers 10 years ago during Seattle. That does it for The Morning Show. I'm Brian Edwards-Tickert, sitting in for Philip Maldry this week. My co-host and co-producer is Amy Allison, executive producer Laura Privis, also producer Esther Mania. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. If you have comments or feedback, mail us at morningshow@kpfa.org. This is KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, or on the web at www.kpfa.org. Please stay tuned. We got Democracy Now! Coming up in 20 seconds.
Meu pai só dizia assim, nega. Minha mãe dizia assim, sem falar. Mulher que fala muito, perde logo seu amor.